Hello, this is Richard Davis, welcoming you to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be hearing about online open days at the Regency Townhouse, and also getting advice on whether we should or should not take our pets on holiday with us. Then we'll be hearing about some new pieces of consumer electronics that will be in the shops before Christmas, namely smart radios, and finding out exactly what that means. And finally, we'll be getting some advice from a professional security expert on how to remain secure online when we're working from home, as many people have been during the course of the pandemic, and some still are. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses, and telephone numbers during the course of the programme. So you might like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So let's get started by hearing about the virtual heritage open days that are taking place at the Regency Townhouse in Hove. For several years now, the National Trust has been running a scheme at this time of the year known as Heritage Open Days. The aim of the scheme is to allow members of the public to have access to areas in historic buildings which they wouldn't normally be able to see. In Brighton and Hove, the main participant in this is the Regency Townhouse, which is in Brunswick Square in Hove. But unfortunately this year, of course, because of the coronavirus crisis, these live open days have had to be cancelled, since people aren't able to go and visit the various properties concerned. However, not to be deterred, the staff at the Regency Townhouse have decided that they're going to hold virtual online open days, the first of which comes up on Saturday, the 11th of September. To find out more, I spoke to Paul Couchman, whom Radio Reverb listeners may well know as the Regency Cook from the Food and Drink Show. I began by asking Paul to tell us a little bit about the Regency Townhouse for the benefit of people who hadn't come across it before.
So the Regency Townhouse is a restoration and history project, and it was set up by Nick Tyson, who's the curator, in 1984. So it's been going a long, long time. And in that period, they've created a lot of history resources for people to enjoy, especially online. And then the house is very slowly changing. So every time you go in, another room has been slightly put back to how it was. So the aim is the whole house would be restored back to how it looked in the 1830s. We're at 13 Brunswick Square. Yeah, that's it. It's hard to explain. A lot goes on there, so it's very hard to break it down into a few sentences. But I hope that gives you an idea.
And under normal circumstances, the townhouse would be open to the public at certain times of the week, would it?
Yeah. During COVID, from March onwards, the house has been shut down. So we put newsletters together, we do social media, all of it still happens, but the house itself lies empty.
So, Paul, what are Heritage Open Days?
So Heritage Open Days is an event that happens every year. It happens all over the country, and usually loads of places are open. You can visit lots of heritage places. There's lots of events organised. But of course, with COVID-19, everything's changed a bit. So there will be a few events going ahead, but a lot of the houses aren't opening and the townhouse isn't opening. So what we're doing is offering some virtual events. And we've got 5 events coming up. It's not the same, but hopefully they will still get people interested in what the townhouse does. That's the idea anyway.
Yes, and in a way, it's almost easier to sit at home and take part in these virtual events than it is to traipse around Brighton. So you never know, you may get some people who don't go out very much joining in.
What we're finding, actually, it's really interesting with the bookings, is you're getting people from all over the world now. It's no longer people that just can come from Brighton and Hove. I've got people from Canada coming, from America. There's one lady who's getting up especially because of the times and stuff. She has to get up at 4:30 in the morning to come along to the talk about cooking. Isn't that lovely? I mean, that's really nice of her.
Yes, and no doubt it'll become a regular feature of the Heritage Open Days in the future now they've tried it out. Okay, well, perhaps you'd like to give me a rundown of the various events. First one on the list I've got here is actually at the Regency Townhouse, and it's an online tour.
That's right. Nick Tyson, the curator, is going to give an online tour. So this is his usual tour, which he's actually going to do on Zoom. because he's been doing it so long, he's got so much knowledge. And so his tours are absolutely fascinating. I've been on the tour about 5 or 6 times because I keep picking up bits and pieces of new information. It's really worth going on. He's very engaging. He tells lots of really funny and passionate and sad stories to go along with it. It's an hour and a half, so I mean, grab yourself a cup of tea and a biscuit as well. Sit down and enjoy it. And you're able to do it right in front of your computer as well, so you don't have to brace the sometimes very cold rain and wind that we get on Brunswick Square for the first bit of his tour. And he'll take you around the whole project and tell you about what we're doing and the restoration and the history of the building. I'm sure there'll be a chance to ask questions at the end and stuff as well. I'm sure he's going to make it as interactive as possible. Absolutely fascinating. I highly recommend it.
So that's on Friday the 11th of September, 9:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. And then I notice that on the afternoon of that same day, Nick Tyson's doing another presentation, which is how to discover the history of a Brighton and Hove house.
Yes. We've got an amazing project. It used to be called My House, My Street. And now it's called Here in the Past. And basically, what the volunteers do that work on this is collect all the information that's available in street directories and censuses, all these sort of paper sources of information. They put it into a massive database. And what you can then do yourself is find out about your own property, about your own house. And you can find out, for example, who was sleeping in your bedroom 100 years ago, maybe 200 years ago. It depends how old your house is. Find out all the information. Those sort of things bring your house to life. So if you have an old property in Brighton and Hove, come along to that event. And Nick can tell you how you can discover your own history of your own house. If you're lucky enough to live in an old house.
Of course, when Paul says come along, he means come along online, not in the flesh, as it were. All these events are taking place online rather than you actually having to go to them. That's on the same day we were talking about, Friday the 11th of September, from 2 till 3pm. Yes, who's been sleeping in my bed or who's been sleeping in my porridge? Which brings us neatly onto the next event, which I think you have a certain personal involvement with, Paul, because I notice that there's a reference to the Regency Cook as being the presenter of this next presentation, which is on the following day, and it's all about a Regency kitchen.
Yeah. For the people that don't know, the townhouse has the most amazing kitchen, which has very gradually been restored back to its former glory. And what we do in that kitchen is actually cook. But strangely enough, a lot of historic houses, you see these lovely kitchens and everything's arranged as if food has been made. Often food hasn't been made for hundreds of years and it's just a bit of theatre, all a bit of scenery. What we do at the townhouse is actually make the food and actually serve it to people and let people come and eat it. So I'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about the history of the kitchen, about how we've restored it. Then we'll be talking about how people used it in the past. And then we'll be talking about how we use it now. So like I said, we've brought it back to life and we've created food events. Because I think there's nothing better if you go into a historic house. If you walk in through the front door and start smelling cakes being baked downstairs or pickles being made, it brings it all to life. And that's really what the townhouse is all about. It's trying to bring history back to life, you know, to get people enthused about it. And if you like food, I encourage you to come along to this, learn about the food, but also learn about the history. So through the food, you can get into the history.
And of course, cooking is one of your passions, isn't it?
Yeah, you can probably hear in my voice, yes.
So that's on Saturday the 12th of September at 10 a.m. The next thing I have on the list here is setting the table for a meal. That's the following day. That's on Sunday at 11.
Yeah. Again, that's me. I'm doing a lot of events this year. What I've decided to do for this one, this is going to be fun. And this is a bit of an experiment. So it could all go terribly wrong, but it will be fun anyway. So basically what I'm doing is you're coming to this Zoom meeting and in 30 minutes, you're going to know how to set a table in 1830. I'm going to run you through all the instructions. The clock will be ticking because our housekeeper, Mrs. Finnegan, will be waiting outside, waiting to receive you as a new servant. So you'll need to know your stuff. So I'm going to give you all the basics so that when Mrs. Finnegan comes in at the end of the presentation, you'll be able to say, yes, I know where things go. I know how to set the table. I know what goes where. Because it's not easy. In the 1830s, things were done differently. Tables were set differently. Food was eaten differently. And I'll run through all of that in the presentation. And at the end, you'll learn loads about history, loads about food, and you'll be able to not lose your job as a new servant at the townhouse.
There are people who used to watch Downton Abbey when it was on, and in the opening sequence, one of the shots showed a hand, a gloved hand, I think it was, with a ruler on the table, measuring how far apart pieces of cutlery should be.
From the edge of the table, yeah, really important. Yeah. Yeah, I'm up for all that, yeah.
Okay, that's on Sunday the 13th of September at 11 a.m. Talking about Mrs. Finnegan, she's something of an institution at the townhouse, isn't she?
So Mrs. Finnegan, I should say, a lot of people don't think this, but she is fictional. We did make her up. She's an 1830s housekeeper who's quite active on Twitter, and who runs her own weekly column where she talks about what goes on for a housekeeper who's actually trapped alone in the townhouse at the moment. The family have left for the country. They've taken the cook, which is me. I'm not there either. And Mrs. Finnegan is actually completely alone in the townhouse, and she writes and tweets about what goes on for a woman of a certain age in a house all by herself.
The reason I mention her is because there's actually a presentation about her taking place on Sunday the 20th of September at 12:30.
I do this together with Bridget. Well, Bridget does most of the writing. I do all the publicity for it. We've created Mrs. Finnegan, Bridget Whelan, who's a writer, and I. And what we're going to do in the presentation is we're going to pull back the curtain and reveal the Mrs. Finnegan secrets. So how we create a historic character, how we make her sound real, and how we do it day after day, producing information and humour. Because what we try and do is mix history and humour together. Because she's not a boring woman. She has opinions and she sees things very well. So it's kind of a way of learning about history in an engaging and fun way. Again, it's what I talked about with the cooking. So if you want to know how you create a fictional character on Twitter, how you do that and what sources we used and how that happens, come along to that event. It's on Sunday, isn't it? 12:30.
Yes, Sunday the 20th of September, 12:30. Okay, well, actually, going back in time a little bit, I've taken things out of sequence, but it seemed logical to do that. The last of the events that you're running from the townhouse is entitled English Puddings, which sounds quite interesting. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
And this is something I did last year for Heritage Open Days, when we could, do it in person. And I actually boiled up a few puddings and served them to people to taste. So when people came to the event, they could actually smell, boiling pudding through the corridors, which is great. So what I'm going to do is try and recreate that online with history of the English pudding, looking at some favourites, things like, well, I don't know, what is your favourite pudding? Because I always ask this, what's your favourite pudding, Richard?
What's it called? It's the one that has all the different summer fruits in it.
Summer pudding, summer pudding. Perfect for now. Mm. Yeah. Running through puddings like that. I'll be running through summer pudding. I'll be talking about roly poly. And of course, Christmas pudding. I don't know if you like, I love Christmas pudding.
I shouldn't have forgotten that.
I'll be running through all the puddings like that and we'll be looking at the history of them. And I'll be talking about the origins. Puddings go right back to Roman periods.
Okay, well, it all sounds great fun and very interesting there, Paul. Where can people get information?
If you go to the Regency Townhouse's website, which is www.rth.org.uk, that's the homepage. Right at the very top, you click on that link. There's a little page then that comes up with all the events.
I notice on the list that I've got, it says that it's free, but pre-booking is required. How do people actually book?
So we've got all the links on the website and you click through and basically go on to Eventbrite, which is a sort of booking platform, and you book your place there. And I will send all the Zoom links by email to people. So we send them all out. So people just basically have to open the email, click the link, and you open up Zoom.
It all sounds great, Paul. Thanks very much. Hopefully I'll be seeing you online, although not in the flesh, on one of these tours in the future.
Yeah, hope to see you there.
I was talking to Paul Catchman of the Regency Townhouse, who Radio Reverb listeners may well recognise as the Regency cook from the Food and Drink Show, about the forthcoming online events that they're running as part of this year's Heritage Open Days. You can find out more by going to the Regency Townhouse website, which is at www.rth.org.uk. That's www.rth.org.uk. When you get to that web page, you'll find near the top of the page, just under the heading, a line where it says, "Brighton and Hove Open Door is virtually upon us. Find it here." and Find It Here is in red. If you click on Find It Here, it'll take you to a page which gives you details of all the events and allows you to book. Well, following a rather disappointing spring and summer, which have definitely been spoiled by the coronavirus lockdown, the situation is easing a bit now, and people who would have gone on holiday earlier in the year are seizing the chance to get away. If you're one of the many people who has a pet, such as a cat or a dog, the question arises as to what to do with your pets while you're away on holiday, and the temptation is always to take them with you. But that may not be the best thing to do. A week or two back, I spoke to Kerry Taylor, the education manager of Blue Cross. And I began by asking her why it is people want to take their pets away on holiday with them.
We love our pets and we want to spend as much time with them as possible, but it isn't always the right thing to do to take them on holiday with you. So sometimes if you've got a pet who actually wouldn't enjoy being away from home or in a strange environment, kennels, for example, or a family member looking after them might be a better option. So although it's a lovely idea that we take our pets away, it's not always the right option for some pets. But obviously pets can't look after themselves. And if we are going away, we really do need to plan to make sure that they are looked after.
The question of taking pets away on holiday, it has certain complications, doesn't it? I mean, I can see that a dog would be very happy to follow its owner almost anywhere. But that's not the case with a cat. The cats tend to be rather more attached to places rather than people. Is that likely to present problems if you want to take a cat away on holiday with you?
Yeah, so we know that dogs generally, and the majority of them, are really sociable and adaptable. They're used to being in the car, and so it's easier to take those on holiday. Whereas a pet like a cat, for example, is very used to their home environment. And we have to think about, actually, is it the best option for that pet? So you would have to think very carefully about taking a cat away. You'd have to travel them in the car, so they'd need a really safe cat carrier to be in. And also when you get there, if they're going to have to be shut in a room for the whole time, is it actually any fun for them? So actually it might be better to look at leaving them at home, either in a cattery or whether you've got a friend or family member who can look after them. We need to make sure that they're getting their basic needs, food and water. They can go out and roam around, go to the toilet when they need to. The other thing to bear in mind is actually many cats really enjoy social interaction. So if you've got a cat who loves being on your lap, really enjoys a fuss, then maybe someone going in twice a day to feed and water them and check them might not be enough. So it is about, you know, knowing your cat and also the type of personality that they have. So you can make sure that they're going to be just as well looked after at home while you're away.
And of course, even with dogs, there are problems in taking them away, especially if you want to go abroad with them.
Yes, yes, they are. And actually, our survey found that just over 50% of people are worried about taking their pets on a plane, for example, or on a ferry. And it's important to remember that traveling for pets, especially on a plane, it would be very strange for them. They wouldn't be used to that environment. So really, you don't want to do that if it was essential. Ferries, you can have a look at different types of ferries and whether you can take your dog in on the board with you, so rather than leave them in the car. But those concerns, I think, really show that that is why 76% of people who were surveyed are really keen on holidaying in the UK and making it even easier and accessible to take their pets with them.
Yes, do you think people have grown closer to their pets during the lockdown?
I do, yeah. I think during lockdown, it's been really difficult for people in many ways. Having a pet at home can offer you so much friendship, companionship, fresh air as well, because it makes you get out. And I really enjoyed being around my dog all the time. It's been really nice. You know, so I do think it's probably built better relationships for pets and people. And people are more aware of those amazing benefits that pets can bring us.
Yes, that could be part of the reason that they're keener this year to holiday in the UK so that they can take the pets away with them.
Yes, I think that has probably had an impact on why it's become so popular.
When you take a dog abroad, especially if you take it outside Europe, are there questions about vaccinations and that sort of thing?
Yes, if you're taking pets outside, you know, for example, UK to Europe, you'll need to do your research, look at passports, make sure your pet is fit and healthy, and that they're up to date with their vaccinations, all of those things. So you want to make sure that actually your pet is fit and healthy enough to travel outside of the UK. And it's also important to do those local research as well, just in case you don't want to miss anything where a country has a requirement, for example, about a pet entering.
When we finally leave the EU for real, is that going to affect matters like that? Is it going to be more difficult in health terms to take a pet to Europe, for example?
It may do, and that's the sort of thing that we're looking at, so where we can help try and support owners in doing that. So as things start to progress and we know what's happening, then it may be that requirements do slightly change. So it's important before you make the trip that you really do your research and check if there's any local restrictions with your pet travelling.
So where can people find out more information about this subject?
So we've got lots of tips about taking your pet on holiday with you if you go to bluecross.org.uk. And there's also some great information about how Blue Cross help pets in need and how you can also help support us.
Okay, Kerry Taylor, thank you very much. I was talking to Kerry Taylor, the education manager of Blue Cross, about whether you should take your pets on holiday with you. If you want to find out more, you can go to the Blue Cross website, which is at www.bluecross.org.uk. That's www.bluecross.org.uk. Well, it seems that in the field of consumer electronics these days, pretty well everything that we can buy is described as being smart. I mean, we've had smartphones and smart televisions and smart loudspeakers. Well, very shortly, a new smart device is going to be hitting the market. It's called a smart radio, and there's a flashy new logo to identify it. Well, I didn't know what was meant by a smart radio. So to find out, I spoke to James Taylor of the company Frontier Smart Technologies, who are the prime movers behind this scheme, and I asked him to tell me more.
Probably about a year ago, we got feedback via brands and some consumers that end users were getting confused around all the modern technologies and modern ways of listening to radio, and they were getting confused when they were looking for products. You obviously had analog radios or FM radios and digital DAB radios, but there was lots of other ways of listening to radio. So, for example, you could have a Bluetooth speaker and listen to it over your phone. You also had internet radio, and you also had a concept of smart speakers, which were quite advanced speakers that connect to the internet and can play content and radio from different services. So there was quite a lot of confusion in the market. So working with some of the leading radio brands, we wanted to create a term that end users would understand. So when they went into a shop or were online, if they looked at a term, they would understand exactly what they were getting and what the benefits were.
So does any radio that has the new logo necessarily have all the features that are in the specification?
Exactly, yes. We wanted to create a logo. Say when someone sees the logo on the box or in the shop, they would understand, as you said, the specification that that radio meets. And then that's where we coined the term smart radio. We looked around and tried to understand which name would mean the most to consumers. We took quite a lot of inspiration from television. So I think smart TV is fairly well understood now. And a smart TV effectively means a television set which allows you to watch TV, plus you can watch on-demand content through apps such as the BBC iPlayer, Netflix, Amazon Prime. So for us and for the logo, what the smart radio means is it's a radio. I think that's the key thing, is that it is a FM and digital radio. So it builds on top of that. Plus, it also has the ability to connect to the internet to get additional content.
And is it like a smart speaker in that you can tell it what to do verbally?
No, we haven't put voice as a specification. And the reason for that is that we felt that potentially in the future, possibly, yes, but we didn't think that was a kind of a mandatory thing that a radio had.
It's just that when people think of a smart speaker, that's one of the things they tend to think of, like an Alexa or something, where you can speak to it to tell it what to do and it'll do it.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think that when we looked at it, we also found that a lot of people just wanted a smart radio to be able to get the content over the internet. So the sort of contents that we have on the smart radio is internet radio, which effectively means you can get, I think, over 30,000 radio stations from all around the globe. So, for example, in the UK, you could listen to radio from the United States or anywhere in the world, and that's live radio. In addition to that, we also have podcasts, so you can listen to podcasts online. And podcasts is a growing category which more and more listeners are listening into. And frequently with broadcast radio, they reference the podcasts. So people can go and do a search from their radio and download the latest podcasts. And in addition to that, we also offer support for streaming content. Lots of music services have been streamed online, people like Spotify, Amazon Music. So there's also the opportunity to support that once the radio is connected to the internet.
Actually, radios like this have been around for some time, haven't they? But what you're doing is giving them a brand so that people can find them easily.
Exactly, yes. You're quite right. They have been around for a long time. And yeah, it's a kind of brand. I think it's more of almost a sort of standard that when a customer sees that logo, they know exactly what they're going to get and not have sort of questions over what the radio does.
A bit like the digital radio tick mark that precedes it.
Exactly.
Are smart radios more expensive than ordinary radios?
Yes, because effectively inside the radio, you've got a DAB radio, plus you've got the mechanism to connect to the internet. And also it generally has a more powerful set of electronics inside to be able to do things such as streaming music from the internet. So yes, they will be more expensive. I couldn't really give you any numbers because we don't manufacture the final radio. We supply the solution to the brands and then they create the products and the price.
Non-smart radios are still going to be available for people who don't want to pay for all the facilities.
Absolutely, yeah. This is something which is not going to replace DAB radios. I think there's a lot of people who like the simplicity of digital radio. The fact that you can turn it on and it works, you don't have to connect it to the Wi-Fi. And I think DAB is a fantastic solution which works really well. So this is almost like DAB with something built on top of it, which is that internet functionality, which is for the users which want to effectively be able to get more content over and above what's offered by DAB+.
This is a scheme you've come up with in conjunction with various radio manufacturers, presumably. How many manufacturers are now on board?
In terms of numbers, we've got 18 brands on board. To give you an example of some of the brands that we've got Roberts, Majority, John Lewis, Rock Audio, Pure and Philips. Now, if you go to smartradio.info, which lists all the brands participating, which you can have a look at.
And of course, we'll give listeners more information about the whole scheme. And are the radios available now?
At the moment, I think we're expecting the radios to be available towards the end of the year that's got the logo. What we're actually planning on doing is a follow-up press release. What we're going to do in the coming month is to list all the products which will bear the logo and which will be available on the shelves, probably November, December timeframe.
Just in time for Christmas, in fact.
Exactly.
Okay, so the message probably is if you're thinking of buying an upmarket radio, to hold off for a month or so, and you'll find something extremely good coming up just before the end of the year.
I mean, you know, in fairness, a lot of the products are already on the shelves. They just haven't got the logo yet. But yeah, the logo will be visible in the end of the year.
Okay, well, this all sounds very exciting. James, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Richard.
I was talking to James Taylor of Frontier Smart Technologies about the new smart radios that are going to be appearing on the market within the next few months, hopefully before Christmas. If you want to find out more, and indeed to see what the smart radio logo looks like, you can go to their website, which is at www.smartradio.info. That's www.smartradio.info. Well, I don't need to tell you that as the pandemic continues on its merry way, things are changing for the better. We're starting to get back a little bit towards normality, although what the new normal will be like is anybody's guess. And of course, one of the things that's changing is that some people are going back to work after many weeks of working from home. Lots of people are still working from home as well because it has many advantages. But it can raise security problems, which may not occur to us. To find out more, I spoke to J.P. Kavanagh of Unisys, who've just produced a report on cybersecurity during the lockdown. And I began by asking him who Unisys are.
It's a global information technology company that builds high-performance security-centric solutions for the most demanding businesses and governments.
And the reason you're talking to me today is that Unisys has produced a report about cybersecurity, and it shows that because of the current corona crisis, most people seem to be more worried about their health than they are about their cybersecurity.
Well, yes, actually, they're even more worried about the impact of this on the NHS and the economy as well. 61% are more concerned about COVID-19's impact on the NHS and the economy over their own personal health, which was 41%. And then the online threats and viruses were down at 31%. So it's a fairly big gap.
And this is a problem, of course, because with the COVID crisis going on and most people now working from home, it's open season for hackers and cyber criminals to get their malware onto people's computers.
Yes, absolutely. So what's happened now is that where people have gone from a safer environment, a more secure environment, not an absolutely secure environment in the workplace, because there's no such thing, but they've gone to their homes to work, where you are then connecting to your home network. There may be other PCs and tablets and devices within your household that are already infected with malware. So when you add another device to that network, there's the possibility that that becomes infected. And what most people also do is when they sign up for broadband connection and they get their router delivered from whatever provider they choose, they tend to think that that's it. And the password is on the bottom of the router, but they don't realize that that's variably a default password. So it could be found and it can probably be hacked much more easily than a very secure password that you think up yourself. So first thing that people should be doing is changing their router password and then putting some other measures in place, which I can go into later on.
Yes, and of course, at work, you have IT professionals to look after the computer security for you. You don't have to think about it yourself.
That's right.
Now, this program at home this morning is directed mainly towards older people, and I was very interested to see in the notes that I've got here that over 55s tend to be a lot more savvy on cybersecurity than the younger generation do.
Yes, that was a surprising result that came out of the index. My view on that actually is that I think in the era that we grew up in, where at home we had a telephone and that was it, there was no answering machine, there was no ability to take voicemails. The only personal data that was out in the public domain would be a name, address and a phone number in the old telephone books. And so therefore we had total control really of our personal data. And I think what's happened as the 55s and above have started to embrace this digital technology and this fourth industrial revolution, if you like, whenever they're asked to put these personal details into a website or an app or whatever, they're naturally more suspicious about it. Because, well, what do you need that for? Why do you need my date of birth? What are you going to do with it? And I think that's what's driven this savviness, if you like, because we're more inquisitive, more sceptical, whereas the younger generation have been brought up with this digital technology from day one and just see it as part of the fabric of their everyday lives. And also, dare I say it, I think, you know, in certain cases, there is an assumption that the responsibility for the security of the device and the data actually lies with the provider of the technology and the developers of the software that's on the technology, rather than the 55 saying, well, actually, I want to protect my data. And therefore, they become a lot more inquisitive about it.
Yes, and I think our generation were brought up to be more suspicious about giving out information to strangers, weren't they?
Absolutely, yes.
Now, whilst most people, I think, have antivirus software on their computers, I gather that a lot of people don't have any antivirus software on their phones.
No, That's correct. And again, another sort of surprising result actually from this index. And again, the older generation are more likely to have antivirus on their phones. I'm not entirely sure why there isn't more antivirus on mobile devices. It could be due to a misconception that, for example, you know, Apple was always seen as super secure as devices. But that doesn't mean that there isn't malware out there. There's malware out there for everything. And I think installing something like antivirus makes absolute sense. There's plenty of really good quality, very effective antivirus programs out on the market that are totally free. You don't have to spend a penny. And they're being designed today more and more so that they don't impact the actual performance of the device too much. So maybe a few years ago, they were quite heavy and it could degrade the performance of a device. I can't really account for why there is so little AV on phones.
No, I bought a tablet recently and it came without any antivirus software on it. So one of the first things I did was to go online and try and find some. And I was told by various people, oh, well, they don't make antivirus software for tablets because they don't need it.
Okay. Good luck with that.
I did find some in the end, but the attitude seemed to be, oh, well, why bother about antivirus software? Tablets don't get infected. You know, sort of.
Yeah, there is a lot of assumption and misconception in this cyber world.
Okay, so if that's the problem, what should we do about it?
Well, yes, good question. I think the advice that I've been talking about is actually not technology focused, but it's about the human element, because that's what attackers go for. We are the soft underbelly, if you like, of cyber defense. Technology today is really, really effective. It's very difficult to crack encryption algorithms and what have you. So go for the weakest link in the chain, which is the human. You consider that more than 90% of successful cyber breaches were enabled by humans. It gives you an idea of the scale of the problem. So my advice would be to up your vigilance, up your caution, and up your suspicion. So even though you're working from home, it creates a very stressful environment for those people who aren't used to it. And if you haven't got the luxury of being able to have a separate office in your house, your boundaries between work and home are blurring significantly. So are the hours between your work hours and your private life. And this really compounded does create a highly stressful situation, which means your guard will be lowered. So that's why I advocate caution and vigilance. So when an email comes in, look at it carefully. There's no rush to deal with anything. Nobody in your organization would demand that you click on a link immediately for any reason whatsoever. They don't want to take the risk that you could accidentally fire off some malware because you've opened a malicious email. So check the email address that the sender has used. So for example, I work for Unisys, unisys.com, and an attacker would, for example, swap the Y and the I around. So when I see the email, my brain will read Unisys because I'm used to seeing that. I'm expecting to see that. But actually, it could be a malicious email because the address isn't correct. So check the address. If it's from somebody within the company ordering you to do something or release funds and that, contact that person. Not through that email, but send them a separate email to the known email address that you're happy with. Phone them up. Phone a colleague up. Don't remain isolated in your home in a bubble, wondering what am I going to do, because you will make a mistake. So keep the communication channels open. Obviously, in any email, be very, very careful about links in an email and doubly, doubly careful about any attachments in that email. Look at the language of the email as well. Are you expecting poor grammar and poor spelling? Does it read like English if it comes from an English person or an English speaking person? So little things like that, you're looking for alarm bells to start ringing. And as soon as one alarm bell starts ringing, you might as well activate all of the alarm bells and start digging into the email and either make an inquiry or put it in the bin. If it's genuine from the company, they'll contact you again. Spammers and cyber criminals won't re-email you unless it's a targeted email attack and you happen to be quite senior in the company, for example. What we refer to as whaling attacks these days, going for the big fish. On top of the email as well, watch out for non-secure websites. If you're logging onto a website, in the top URL bar there where the address is, have a look for HTTPS. The S signifies that your communication with that website is encrypted, that it's the genuine website because the website will have gone through verification and you know that you're connected to whichever site it is. No S there, be suspicious. Your traffic could be directed to somewhere else. And then probably finally public Wi-Fi. Yeah, so people are getting out a bit more now. And I'm always amazed before lockdown, if I went to a coffee shop or somewhere like that, airports even, the number of people hooking into public Wi-Fi, but not realizing that most of them are not encrypted. If they go to a coffee shop, think, I'll have a nice cup of coffee. I might book myself a short weekend break. They're going online. They're passing bank details, bank card details, personal details in clear text across an unencrypted Wi-Fi network. And somebody sitting near you is probably hoovering that information up, unbeknownst to you or anybody else, which they can then use for, obviously, for nefarious purposes. So if you're going to use public Wi-Fi, only use it for general browsing, put no details in there, don't book anything, don't do any online banking with it. Just use it if you need to browse, but without interacting with it, shall we say.
Okay, well, that's been very helpful. JP Cavanagh, thanks very much.
Thanks very much indeed, Richard. Pleasure to meet you.
JP Cavanagh of Unisys has been telling me the precautions we can take in order to stay secure online, especially when working from home or when using public Wi-Fi. And that brings us to the end of the programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in the last hour. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you again in 4 weeks. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with either Chris or me to let us know what you think of the programme, or perhaps to suggest items you might like us to cover, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us by email, and the email address is info@greymattersproductions.org.uk. That's info, I-N-F-O, at greymattersproductions.org.uk. And as I say, we'd love to hear from you. So it now only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to wish you all the very best until we meet again. Take care. Goodbye.